Hello there, I'm Nastasia Tay, and this is Counting the Cost on Al Jazeera, your weekly look at the world of business and economics. This week, the push to counter China in Asia. US President Joe Biden launches the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. So what's in the new pact, and will it help build Washington's relations in the region? Also this week, Ukraine's economy is running on fumes. The EU, US, and the G7 have come to the nation's aid with billions of dollars, but is it enough to keep the country running? And a wealth of mineral resources in Africa. Miners are increasingly looking to the continent as the world scrambles for metals. So will Africa's mining industry see a boom from the war in Ukraine? Well, the US has lacked a defined economic plan with the Indo-Pacific region since former President Donald Trump quit a multinational trans-Pacific trade agreement back in 2017. Now, President Joe Biden is attempting to re-engage the region that's increasingly come under China's influence. Biden has launched a new trade deal with 12 countries that represent 40% of the world's economy. That's almost $35 trillion in global output. It includes Australia, India, Japan, South Korea and New Zealand, along with seven Southeast Asian countries. But the US didn't ask Taiwan, which is seen by China as part of its territory, to join the new trade deal. The Indo-Pacific Economic Framework for Prosperity, or IPEF, aims to increase trade links in the region, strengthen global supply chains, promote infrastructure investment and clean energy, and establish new rules on tax and anti-corruption. But it doesn't include any tariff reductions, and the founding countries will still need to negotiate what standards they wish to abide by, how they'll be enforced, and how to consider potential future members. The initiative comes less than 5 months after the China-led Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership went into force, linking 15 Asia-Pacific economies and the world's largest trade bloc. Most of the countries which signed up for the US-led framework already belong to the bloc with China. Well, meanwhile, Beijing has criticized the US pact as an attempt to create a closed club. This is what the Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesperson had to say.
Whatever the name of the regional cooperation framework, it should promote free trade instead of engaging in protectionism in disguise. It should contribute to the world's economic recovery rather than destabilizing the industrial chain. It should promote open cooperation instead of geopolitical confrontation. The U.S. should earnestly act in compliance with the rules of free trade.
Now, Biden has also held a summit with the so-called Quad Group, where the leaders of the U.S., Japan, India and Australia unveiled an Indo-Pacific maritime surveillance plan and pledged $50 billion in infrastructure investment. Now, to discuss all of that, I'm joined by Jens Prestus. He's a Southeast Asia expert and associate director at Global Council. That's a strategic advisory business firm. He joins us now from London. Jens, thanks so much for your time today. Now, IPEF isn't a free trade agreement. We're not talking about tariff reduction or necessarily opening up US markets. So what does it actually do?
Obviously, you're right. It's not a free trade agreement. The main purpose is more to for the countries in the group, in IPEF, to seek to align on things like technology standards and regulations, and for these countries to make real commitments to improve conditions on things like supply chain resilience, mm-hmm. on clean energy infrastructure, corruption, and labor and competition policy. So it's more about the technology standards and coming together to align on regulations.
Sure, but yes, obviously that all sounds like it would potentially require countries to change laws at home. Are there incentives for them to do that?
So exactly. So that's the point. So that's one of the issues with this agreement, in that a lot of these countries do probably not see eye to eye on a lot of these things. And so the complication is that they might not come to any agreements. In terms of incentives, so you're right, there's no incentives in terms of better access to the American market for a lot of these countries. But that's not to say that that they might not become that in the future. Obviously, it might become something more tangible, perhaps not a free trade agreement, but something more tangible in the future. And that is not something a lot of these countries like Vietnam, Indonesia, would like to miss out on. I think it's important to note that this is more about what is actually in the agreement. It also has a lot of symbolic value. Mm-hmm. It's a sign that the U.S. wants to become more economic involved in the region, which is something pretty much all of these countries have called for a long time, and which the U.S. hasn't been doing. It wants the U.S. to become more of a counter to China's influence, and for them to be able to balance out for for instance, for the countries in the Southeast Asian region, being able to play both the US and China gives them a lot of leverage, you could argue.
Sure. Well, speaking of countering China's influence, I noticed that it obviously excludes Taiwan. Now, given Taiwan's role as a leading manufacturer of semiconductors, for instance, how meaningful would any agreement on, say, supply chains be, given that Taiwan's not being included?
Yeah, so first on the exclusion of Taiwan, that was probably not a big surprise. The US has been pretty clear that it wants to focus its relationship with Taiwan bilaterally. I think a lot of these countries in Southeast Asia, especially as well, would have been uncomfortable with being in a group, including Taiwan, that is so clearly set out to counter Chinese influence. I still think it has some importance. Obviously, it's a negative that Taiwan is not included, but you still have countries like South Korea and Japan, which obviously are huge semiconductor manufacturers themselves, not just now, but will also be in the future. So in that sense, it could really have an impact as well.
Sure. Well, if this was about the US trying to restructure its engagement with the region to counter China, to show its strength there, why not just rejoin the Trans-Pacific Partnership or TPP?
So I think there are mainly domestic constraints that are holding the US back from joining the new CPTPP. If you look at the economic agendas of both the Trump administration and the Biden administration, it's been very focused on strengthening the American manufacturing base. It's been about building American. It's been about buying American. If you join a new large free trade agreement, which will open up an already very open American economy, I think that is something that could potentially further erode the American manufacturing base, which has been a key sticking point and a key issue in domestic debates. And obviously that could potentially be highly unpopular, and it's not something you really win elections on. And when you have the midterms coming up later this year, that's a sensitive issue at home.
Jens, I want to ask you, though, about how this might affect China, because I was looking at the list of the countries who've signed up to IPEF, and a huge number of these countries are also part of the world's biggest trade bloc with China. Will this actually have any kind of an impact on Beijing's influence in that case?
So it's actually interesting that if you look at the the statement when they announced the deal, it was made a point that this group comprised of 40% of world GDP. RCEP, which China is a member of, is only 30%. So even though it's not a free trade agreement, I assume the US still wanted to make a point of saying that this is a bigger group. It's more important, and it could become a free trade agreement in the future. But to your question, I think. I think the fact that some of these countries in the region, Cambodia, Laos, did not join, tells you that the countries that didn't want to be part of it have already opted to not be included. And the other countries that are sitting a bit on the fence, wanted more US involvement, they've still opted to join. And that tells you something about that it actually has a future, and it's still something that that can be a real value.
Sure. Jens, I want to get your thoughts finally on the US perspective on the whole region. It's obviously a sensitive region, both for trade and security. Which do you think is trumping the other, especially now given the war in Ukraine and Biden's most recent comments on Taiwan?
I think security still trumps everything, and not just because domestic politics is constraining the Americans from being more economically involved, but that is ultimately what they come back to. It's about protecting sea lanes. It's about protecting Taiwan and other allies in the region. So security is probably more important for the Americans, even though they kind of forced to show that they also want to be more economically involved too.
Indeed, and all of it's very much related one to the other. Jens Prestis there, a Southeast Asia expert, joining us from London. Thank you so much for your time, Jens.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's turn now to Ukraine. Buildings and bridges destroyed, farmland turned into battlefields, and ports blocked from exporting grain and goods. Ukraine's economy is in ruins as a result of Russia's invasion. And Kyiv desperately needs money to pay salaries, finance public services, maintain infrastructure. President Volodymyr Zelensky appealed to world leaders at the World Economic Forum in Davos to increase funding and help rebuild his shattered country after the war ends. The European Union has pledged more than $10 billion in financial aid just 24 hours after the Ukrainian president made his appeal. The group of seven leading economies, the G7, has pledged almost $20 billion. while the US approved an additional $40 billion in military, humanitarian and economic aid, bringing the total US assistance to Ukraine to almost $54 billion this year. That's the largest package of foreign aid passed by Congress in at least two decades. But the Ukrainian government estimates that the country needs an additional $5 billion each month to cover essential services and pay soldiers' salaries. The World Bank says the economy is set to shrink by as much as 45% this year. Now, Ukraine exports 4.5 million tons of agricultural produce per month, but grain exports have more than halved this month. Customs revenues, a significant part of the government's tax take, have also crashed to around a quarter of their pre-war level. The direct damage to Ukraine's infrastructure alone is estimated at more than $94 billion. And the overall reconstruction effort is expected to cost at least $600 billion. Now, in addition to the aid packages, the U.S. also says it will suspend tariffs on Ukrainian steel for 1 year, citing the damage that Russia's war in Ukraine has done to the industry. Ukraine is the 13th largest steel producer and exports at least 80% of its production. And the EU will lift import duties on Ukrainian goods, including industrial and agricultural products, for a year. Well, joining us now from London is Evgenia Sleptsova. She is a senior economist at Oxford Economics. Evgenia, thank you for joining us on Counting the Cost today. It really feels like Ukraine's economy in itself has become a bit of a front line of its own. What's your reading of how Kyiv is handling things?
Well, indeed, yeah, Ukraine is fighting the war on all fronts, military, social, economic. The economy has contracted by about 45% in the first month, which is, well, basically nearly halving. And there are signs, however, that the economy is adjusting since then. So from April onwards, there are signs that the economy is adjusting and some regions have been liberated. So obviously the military response has been quite remarkable, and the economic one as well. Both the monetary and the fiscal response has been quite professional and enabled stability, financial stability, stability of currency. But there are challenges, of course, because there are huge costs involved, both with related to the collapse in revenue, but also the additional expenditures required for the war itself.
So this estimate of needing, what, $5 billion every month just for salaries and essential services, how far will all the aid go, especially given that we don't actually even know how long this war will last?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and these are big amounts of money. I mean, $5 billion, the estimate of $5 billion per month includes the fiscal deficit and debt service costs. So it's not just the daily costs related to social spending, et cetera, but also the debt service costs. And it's split around $3 billion deficit we've seen so far, and about $1.5 to $2 billion debt service costs. And so far, the amounts that have been pledged by the international community and partners are bigger than what has been coming in. So, for example, in March, there was $3 billion. In April, there was very little. There was less than $1 billion. In March, in May, again, so far, there's been a scale up. So there's about $2.8 billion received. But it's certainly short of $5 billion that is necessary. And as a result, the central bank had to switch on the money printing machine, essentially, and monetize the deficit. And it doesn't like doing that. Mm. And it is already putting pressure on the currency and will be potentially creating inflationary pressures.
Well, given that the world itself is potentially staring down the barrel of a recession, given the pandemic, given what they've now committed to Ukraine, what's your reading then on whether the West can actually even afford any of this right now?
Well, I think these amounts are certainly affordable. We are seeing a lot of numbers in the media, like a $40 billion package from the US or $19 billion package from the G7 and $9 billion from the EU. We need to understand that the real cash is much smaller. So from the US, we're speaking about $8 billion, and it can be stretched over several years, according to the law. Again, it's not clear over what period of time EU plans to allocate $9 billion euros. So, you know, the amount's not as big as we're hearing, and it is affordable. And also Ukraine has been asking for international partners, rich countries in particular, to use their SDR allocation that was given for basically overcoming the COVID crisis and recession. And there is about 295 billion allocated in SDR, in IMF reserve currency, to the rich countries, which has not been used. So Ukraine has been lobbying for at least part of that money to be allocated to Ukraine.
That's very interesting, because we have seen this huge show of solidarity from the West. Do you think that to some extent we're seeing an even bigger rift being driven between East and West, say between the West and Russia and China, not only politically but also economically here?
Well, economically, obviously, sanctions are having a huge impact, and Russia is becoming more and more isolated. So clearly, yes, it hasn't served well for Russia's place in the world economically, and it will see its exports of gas and oil also reduced by the EU, even albeit gradually. With China, you know, China is playing a balancing game. China has not taken a very clearly pro-Russian stance. It is still realizing that it's very much integrated economically with the West.
All very interesting indeed. We'll see how this all continues to play out. Evgenia Slipsova, there, a senior economist at Oxford Economics. Thank you for sharing your insights with us here on Counting the Cost.
Thank you for reaching out.
Well, from batteries to semiconductors, cars and mobile phones, minerals such as copper and nickel are a vital part of most of the products that many of us use every day. But they've suddenly become much more expensive and rare because of the war in Ukraine and sanctions on Russia disrupting supply chains. Many mining companies scrambling for new alternatives are now looking to Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says his country is poised to take advantage of this growing demand for platinum group metals. South Africa produces half of the world's palladium, at least 75% of the world's platinum, almost 90% of the world's rhodium, and is also a major coal producer. But up to $2.5 trillion worth of mineral reserves remain unexploited, and the government aims to increase investment in its mining sector twofold to create more jobs and more foreign exchange. And it's not just South Africa. The continent produced almost 1 billion tons of minerals worth $406 billion in 2019. About 63% of the world's cobalt production came from the Democratic Republic of Congo. The DRC and Rwanda are the world's largest producers of tantalum. That's another metal used in electronic equipment. Together, they produce half the world's output. 11 African countries are the main producers of metals, including gold, iron, titanium, zinc, and copper, with Ghana the continent's largest producer of gold. And Botswana is the continent's largest diamond producer. Well, joining us now from London is Henry Sanderson. He is the executive editor at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. That's a price reporting agency and consultancy focused on the metal supply chain. Henry, thanks so much for joining us here on Al Jazeera today. Should African countries be looking at this as a huge opportunity?
Yes, they are looking at this as a huge opportunity, because Africa is blessed with pretty much all the metals and minerals that we need to move from fossil fuels to renewable energy, electric vehicles, and batteries. So they're all working out now how best to capitalize on this opportunity.
Henry, given the security situations in a number of these countries, just how reliable are these supply chains?
Yeah, so in a metal like cobalt, which is used in most electric vehicle batteries, the supply chain is highly concentrated. From the Democratic Republic of Congo, it gets trucked out of the country to ports in South Africa like Durban, and then it goes to China. And we've seen that supply chain come under stress when there are floods in Durban. So that's an example of a very concentrated supply chain that perhaps needs to be diversified. And we've seen Zambia, following the election last year, now saying they want to look for cobalt in Zambia. So we could see that supply chain diversify, which is what we need, right? We don't want to rely on one country or one single supply chain.
Henry, given the amount of opportunity that we're talking about here for both African governments and perhaps some other actors here, is there a greater risk that, say, labour laws or good labour practices might be flouted, or that we might see increased political risk in some scenarios?
I mean, there has been a lot of concern, you're right, in mining activities across the continent. In the DRC, which I mentioned, you know, there have been concerns about people getting paid, you know, the right wages. There's been concerns about child labour there. And, you know, there's also political instability, which I think you referenced, you know, in Mozambique, which is going to become a source of graphite for Tesla. There's also concerns about an insurgency there. So there are sorts of political risks, labour law risks that are going on. But these do need to be tackled for Africa to become a part of these supply chains, because at the other end, the customer, the car maker, the Tesla, they want to know that this supply chain is audited and meets standards and meets, you know, ESG standards, which are becoming more important.
Is this a short stopgap while the war in Ukraine rages on, or is this potentially a longer term shift?
I think because Africa is so blessed with these minerals, this is a longer term shift. And we've seen China, you know, over the last few years, very heavily invest in Africa. And even recently, it's been Chinese investors that are buying lithium assets in Africa. And I guess the question is, are Western mining companies, Western companies going to follow China? And we're seeing that happen already. And that, if they do, that's going to ensure that both the Chinese side of the supply chain and the Western side of the supply chain depend on Africa from a longer term perspective. But we're seeing Western investors come back to some of these countries. But, you know, it's at the beginning stages in some areas.
This all obviously then has foreign policy implications going forward as well. So do you see this as part of a new scramble for Africa from the West again?
I think the West has woken up, definitely. And, you know, countries like the DRC, there's just been so much Chinese investment. I think now the West is aware that, you know, wait a second, you know, almost all the cobalt is controlled by Chinese companies. You know, maybe we need to engage with these countries. We need to go back to these countries. And the big problem for the West was a lot of Western mining companies left, you know, left countries like the DRC or, you know, Zambia because of political issues, because they became quite risk averse. And in a way, some of their investors were telling them not to get engaged. But now I think both companies and governments are looking again at Africa and realizing, you know, we have to be there. We have to, you know, be part of these supply chains. So it is a scramble. I think demand for these minerals is increasing rapidly, and we don't want, you know, China to control a lot of this supply chain. So it is a sort of scramble going on.
Henry Sanderson there, the executive editor at Benchmark Mineral Intelligence. Thanks so much for sharing your thoughts with us on Counting the Cost.
Thanks for having me.
Now, cloth spinners and scientists in Bangladesh have been working together to revive a special fabric. Dhaka muslin was made for royalty, but the technique for producing it was lost for more than a century. Now it's back, thanks to a rare cotton plant. Tanvir Chowdhury reports now from Narayanganj.
This rare cotton plant is native to Bangladesh and for more than a century was believed to be extinct. But now it's been grown on farms to revive trade in the fine cotton. A scientist who led the search for the plant says it has features not found in other species.
It took us around 5 years to find the genetic match for this cotton plant. We collected 39 variants of cotton plant samples from different parts of Bangladesh. Eventually, we found a DNA match of the Phuticarpus cotton from the Kapasia region near Dhaka.
Now new generations of weavers are relearning this once-forgotten craft, but it's not been easy.
Initially, I was skeptical of my ability, but eventually, after many months of steady training and encouragement, we managed to learn and create the first muslin sari. After 5 months of hard work and presented it to the Prime Minister, it was a proud moment for us.
The fabric is so light and fine that poets have described it as woven air. Spinners using traditional wooden wheels and hand-drawn looms have to work for longer to produce muslin than other handmade fabrics.
1 inch of cloth could take 8 hours by two people to make, requiring at least 6 to 7 months to make a full-length sari. The work is highly demanding, requires extreme concentration and attention to details.
Many in Bangladesh blame its former British colonial rulers for killing off the Muslim weaving industry by the late 19th century to make way for their own textile trade. But they're excited it's returning.
We are very proud to be part of this great endeavour, as the world will now get to know about our centuries-old fame and heritage, since we're reviving this craft again in this day and age.
Many hope the revival of muslin will be welcomed by the world's high fashion industry that once helped turn the Ganges Delta into one of the most prosperous parts of the globe.
Well, that's our show for this week. Do get in touch with us by tweeting me, at Nastasia Tay, and do use the hashtag AJCTC when you do. Or drop us an email. countingthecost@aljazeera.net is our address. But there's also more for you online at aljazeera.com/CTC. That'll take you straight to our page, which has individual reports, links, and entire episodes for you to catch up on. Well, that's it for this edition of Counting the Cost. I'm Nastasia Tay. From the whole team here, thanks for joining us. The news on Al Jazeera is next.